This is the voice of Carnage, and you are listening to Carnage Cast.
Hi everyone, welcome to episode 12 of Carnage Cast. It's a Euro kind of show, as we've got Lorian Green on to talk about her new documentary, Going Cardboard. Then, in Autopsy of a Game, Chuck, Rod, and Sarah sit down to talk about Le Havre, one of Uwe Rosenberg's resource management games. And now, let's go to Lorian.
Now, interview with the gamer.
Hi everyone, welcome to Interview with the Gamer. We're talking with Lorian Green tonight, director of Going Cardboard, a documentary about board games. Hi Lorian, how are you?
Hey, good, how you doing?
Pretty good. What's the high overview of Going Cardboard?
Well, basically Going Cardboard is about sort of the next generation of board games, the new board games that have been coming out of, they started coming out of Germany, but also mainly Europe, and they're starting to come out of the United States. But board games like the Settlers of Catan is the flagship as far as United States players are concerned for the style of board game, but it's also known as modern adult strategy games, so just games like that.
Mm-hmm. And so what drove you to make a movie about them?
I was already a fan of documentary. I grew up, you know, a big fan of like Ken Burns and the Civil War documentary, his series and things like that. And it was, I think in 2008 when I saw King of Kong, which is a documentary about Donkey Kong, that I just really got fired up and started, you know, investigating because I didn't feel like it had the full story in there. So I started blogging at exactly that point. That was why I started blogging. And then I started to realize there were all these other documentaries out there about things like LARPing and, you know, Scrabble, you know, and things like that. At the same time, my husband had started playing these designer board games like Catan and Carcassonne and games like that. And I was like, oh, there should be a documentary about this. And I looked it up and there wasn't. So after a while, I just kind of fell into being the one that made it.
So you're sort of coming at this from an outsider's perspective.
Pretty much from an outsider's perspective, because I was a casual gamer. I would describe myself as a casual designer board gamer. I wasn't really hardcore into it. Didn't know the field that well. I didn't know about like Essen, the really big convention, the Spiel convention in Germany, until after I'd already started, you know, investigating this and filming for it. So I didn't know what the story was going to be at all from the outset. I just thought the games were really beautiful and that it seemed to be a really interesting hobby that a lot of people were really enthusiastic about. And that's why I wanted to cover it. But we uncovered a lot of really cool stories along the way.
Mm-hmm. Any stories in particular you want to share now?
One of the things was just timing-wise, I wound up following Donald Vaccarino, the designer of Dominion, basically through the whole cycle of when they'd first come out with Dominion, and then it got nominated for the Spiel des Jahres that year, and then having it win the Spiel des Jahres. And I interviewed both the publisher and him, and actually someone who was on the beta test team for the publisher, and sort of multiple times and was able to watch that story unfold. And so I got lots of different perspectives on it. And it was just a really cool story arc to have completed in the film.
Mm-hmm. Is there a particular story to the film like that? Or is it the whole smorgasbord of the hobby?
It doesn't cover everything about the hobby, but it does give kind of a broad overview. It gives a little bit of history, you know, about how these games came to be the way they are, which I found really interesting as a learning experience for me to find out, you know, why, you know, we've had Monopoly since I was a kid and yet all these games were exploding in Germany. There are reasons why that happened. So that was actually really interesting to find out. But it covers that. It covers the community. I definitely go into the designers, obviously, because people who are familiar with the hobby don't necessarily get to see or hear from the designers that often, even though they might be huge fans of their work. So I thought it was a cool opportunity to kind of actually let people sort of meet their favorite designers, so to speak. So it has that, and then it has a, you know, two or three little kind of mini story arcs following different designers.
Mm-hmm. What was it like reaching out to designers like that?
It was really cool, actually. At first it was a little intimidating, but I had started because our friend was Eric Martin, who ran Board Game News at the time. So he had a lot of contacts, and he kind of introduced me to a lot of people and said, you know, here's so-and-so's contact. They'd be really good to talk to about this. So I got started that way, but then I started to investigate the hobby myself, and I was just like, oh, you know, I should really go for the big fish. Like, I'm going to go after Reiner Knizia, and I'm going to go after, you know, Klaus Teuber and see if they'd be willing to do it. And they were just really cooperative and extremely open to it. So, you know, the whole industry, like, everybody was really cool about it once I actually dove into it, because there hasn't been a documentary like this before. And the people who play these games and design them, everybody in the industry is really passionate about getting the word out. So obviously this is a good vehicle for that. So I had their cooperation.
And was that meeting the big names, was that part of your trip to Essen?
Yes. Yeah, that was one of the big reasons. So there were two major trips that I went on for this. One was the Gathering of Friends, which is a private gathering that Alan Moon puts on. It's mm-hmm. invitationally, but again, you know, like, I was able to get invited to that. And a lot of industry people come together from that, including people from Germany. So I got, you know, like, Freedom on Freeze while I was over there. I got Jay Tummelson, who really is the one that gave the kind of great historical overview of designer board gaming, you know, and just a bunch of other people. But what to get Reiner and to get, you know, Klaus Teuber, that did call for a trip to Essen. And I wanted to film Essen anyway, you know, because I'd heard it was this, like, amazing thing, you know, and that we didn't have anything like it in the States. And that turned out to be quite true. And the film needed to have Essen. If there was going to be a designer board gaming documentary, it needed that. So I was going to go there anyway. But yeah, it's a great place to meet all those designers and publishers.
For something that's indescribable, could you describe Essen?
So I've been to conventions in America before, and, you know, they're video game conventions, and they're usually dark and, you know, lots of lights and stuff and the booth babe thing and all that, you know, and really cool. Like, I really enjoyed that. But when I went to Essen, it was kind of the polar opposite. You know, it's very analog. There aren't a lot of, you know, TV sets. There was a little bit of electronic element to it, but it's mostly completely analog. It's light and bright. It's well lit. You know, everything's just very bright. And the weirdest thing for me was that people were walking around with little kids, like in strollers. You know, there were grandparents there, just like all different generation levels of the family. And that was definitely something that you do not see at conventions in the States. So
right.
That was really interesting.
Did you, when you were shooting the film, did you learn why in Europe and Germany gaming is more multi-generational like that?
I think it's just a more fundamental part of their culture. And it's just, you know, one thing follows another. And they'd created this jury of people to review games and pick, you know, the best game of the year every year. And that sort of led to better games and led to more family-friendly games. And, you know, then basically the culture just grows up around that. And, you know, it formed this family-wide culture of board gaming. And it's just very common, like, for people in Germany, you know, to stop at a pub after work and play board games, like, with their grown-up friends. You know, it's just commonplace. You know, they're in libraries. The games are everywhere. So it's just an interesting part of the culture.
You were comparing that to American conventions. What was your baseline for conventions before Essen?
Well, I had been in the video game industry before this, so I'd actually been to E3 back in the day when it was still, you know, flashing and crazy. I'd been to Origins and some other conventions, you know, minor, smaller conventions. You know, I can't remember if I'd been to PAX before or after. I think after I had been to Essen. But, you know, PAX is actually starting to approach, you know, being the size of Essen, or at least feeling like it. It's more of a, and it's also more of a fun family atmosphere, PAX is. So I think PAX is sort of our answer or our version of the Essen Spiel show. And there's a big board gaming component too, you know, to it. So, and that's one thing that, you know, I started filming this in February of 2009. And in the 3 years since, you've been able to see board gaming starting to take hold more and become more prevalent at our conventions and places like that, you know, and also to be seen more in the common stores. Like, you know, when I started this, I don't think there was anything in Target, you know, or Toys R Us of these designer games, and you are starting to see them there. So it's
right.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
They're making their way over.
Yeah, they're infiltrating sneakily.
Yes, exactly.
So you started filming in 2009. What was your conception then? And of what you wanted to get.
Oh yeah, so and that changed drastically, obviously, through the course of it. But when I started, I was just kind of like, okay, the games are cool. I'd like to talk to designers and see, you know, like what people's favorite games are, you know, why people think the games are cool, why they're good for the community. Sort of those really outlying, very generic questions. And as I got into it, you know, like Eric was like, oh, you should talk to this person. They're a self-publisher, you know, or this person, he's in the process of getting his game published. And I started to like dig into that stuff and find out, you know, more interesting things about the industry. And then all this other stuff started popping up like, oh, they're great for education, you know, and there's the element of the board games being integrated into technology, you know, so like being ported over to Xbox and places like that. So there was that whole side of it, which is super interesting. I mean, there's, you know, the convention side of it. I mean, the competitions, like the World Board Gaming Competition. I didn't even touch on that, but that was something that, you know, I was considering as a possible thing. But mostly I was just trying to do like an advocacy piece and find out what was cool about the games.
Mm-hmm. In the 3 years that you've been shooting, did that plan change at all? Was the footage showing you something else?
The footage kind of led me a lot more towards the designer-publisher side of it, and I kind of, you know, thought that was going to happen. Like, I knew that the designer side would be interesting, but I didn't really know how interesting it was and how it's sort of like, it was very Wild West, the way I would describe it at that point. And I think it still is, but just that an independent designer with a good idea, how easy it is really for that person to get in front of a publisher and show them and really get their shot at having their game published. It's very, very different from other mediums like books or movies, you know, where you pitch your thing and you're expecting like dozens and dozens of rejection letters, you know, like, first of all, there aren't dozens and dozens of publishers. There aren't that many publishers that are going to be interested in your style of game. But they're very open to individuals and to seeing individuals because they don't know where the next big game's coming from. You know, like Donald Vaccarino was a first-time publisher. That was out of nowhere. And, you know, I mean, if they'd passed on that, I mean, look what happened to it. You know, it's Game of the Year for 2009.
Right.
So you can't afford to, you don't know where the next really big hit is coming from, so you can't afford to really overlook people. And I think that's really beneficial for, you know, creative people. They can take advantage of that. And, you know, they had said, you know, just like everyone has a novel in them, everyone has a game in them. And I don't know if that's true for me, but I think the games, like at least the documentary, I think, and through the course of filming it, really, I saw the angle of being inspired to create, you know, and I think that it will have that effect on people. I think it'll make people want to do that. So at least I hope so, because I think that's a really neat element of it.
But you don't think you have a game in yourself?
I don't know. I think maybe like the documentary was my game. You know, like I'm not a mathy person, and there is a big element of that to it. You know, I might come across a really good theme, but I would need like a partner, like a, you know, actual designer who knew what they were doing, you know, because again, I'm a casual gamer, so rules aren't my big thing. You know, like I get them, but only recently when I've started, you know, teaching. We started a thing at work where every Friday at lunchtime we're like playing board games, you know, as sort of a social mixer. And it's great because I'm meeting people in the company that I hadn't met before. So that's case in point exactly what these games are supposed to do. And, you know, it can happen in your own company. But teaching the rules is a hard thing. And some people have the aptitude for it. And really, like, it's been something I've been developing on. But, you know, you have to be at least good at teaching the rules, I would think, to have a really good grasp of rule mechanics and so forth, you know.
And as a casual gamer, what are your games of choice?
I actually really love Dominion. I like Small World. That's a good one. Basically, a lot of the Days of Wonders games. I'm a big fan of Ticket to Ride.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the harder ones I like too, though, like Puerto Rico. I like Goa, which is sort of similar to Puerto Rico in the degree of designer gaming it is. So I like a wide variety of games, but most of the time these days we only have time really for the more casual ones. We haven't played Power Grid or Puerto Rico in a little while, so
right.
Yeah, I'd like to get back to those maybe once this project is done.
And how much further do you think you have to go?
Oh, it's very close to being done. I'm actually just finishing up some tweaking of the subtitles on the DVD itself. Like the DVD menus are all pretty much built out, and the film itself is done. But by the end of the week, the DVD also should be done, or very close to the end of the week, and then that goes to the DVD production place. And then we get a master back, you know, and we make sure it works and try to play it on, you know, lots of things. And then from there, basically, you know, we order it and then we start shipping. So it's really, it should be in the next, you know, it's close, it's coming.
I was curious if the screenings are informing editing choices about your demo.
Well, actually, that premiere screening did have a chance to inform some editing decisions, yes. Because, you know, I had not printed the DVD. It wasn't completely done. And that was just last week, too. So, you know, like, that's how fast these things are moving. But that was one really big benefit to having a public screening at that point, is that I did still have time if people had, you know, specific feedback. Or if, as I'm watching it, you know, I see stuff that I maybe missed before, because it's a whole different venue when it's up on the big screen, you know.
Right.
So, and there were like three or four things like that. So it did make some final little tweaks to it. But overall, people enjoyed it. And the feedback was great from that screening. So, you know, not a lot changed.
So the DVD's about ready to go. Where are people going to be able to find it?
Well, the DVD, I have a brick-and-mortar distributor, Game Salute. They'll be able to pick it up through there, and they also have partnerships with a lot of brick-and-mortar stores, game stores across the country, so it will be in actual game stores in that way. It'll definitely be available on my website for sale, for sure. Those two places to begin with, you know, once I've kind of got my feet and got that whole thing underway and smooth and running, then I'm going to look at some other, you know, options like, you know, iTunes and places like that. And there are some other distributors of indie films that I'll be looking at. But from out the gate, it's definitely going to be those two options, at least.
Are you learning more about digital distribution as you go, or do you have a rough idea what to expect?
I have a very vague idea what to expect. I mean, I know there are various solutions out there. From what I've heard, you know, like, it's harder than the average person would think to get a documentary onto Netflix. That's very, very difficult. So that's one place that, you know, I'm going to hold off for later, because I do have a way that I might be able to do that, but it's not going to be a focus. I've actually heard that iTunes can be challenging too. So we'll see. But, you know, I am aware of Amazon CreateSpace, and I plan to look into that. You know, I know that's a viable option for a single DVD print like this. So that may be one route I go, but, you know, I don't know any details beyond being aware of the options in to that degree, to very basic level.
Right.
So we'll see. But, you know, it's been a learning process the whole way. You know, filming was a learning process. Editing was a learning process. Mastering the DVD has been, you know, yet another learning curve. So it's just one curve after another. So I'm used to it at this point.
At least you're going into it with the right frame of mind.
Yes. Yes.
So was this your first film?
Yes. Oh, yeah. I have no film background. Actually, I will fully admit, before this effort, I did not even have a YouTube channel. I'd never, you know, uploaded anything to YouTube. I had zero video experience, like as zero as you can possibly get. Never even, like, used a camcorder. So, you know, I guess that's a testament to what, you know, the tech will let you get away with these days. You know, that the tech is very consumer friendly, and it's very affordable. So, you know, for someone from like me to go from zero to being able to produce a movie, you know, in 3 years is just astounding. I think it's really just amazing.
Yeah, it's like board games. The barriers to entry have really dropped in the last couple of years.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a very similar situation. And a lot of the things that the designer said when I got to the section where they're giving advice about designing, you know, a lot of it really rang to me from the documentary standpoint as well.
You said earlier that you grew up watching documentaries, and in particular Ken Burns. Mm-hmm. Were there examples or lessons in particular you drew upon when you were shooting this?
Maybe that I shouldn't have worried so much about doing subtitles might be one of them, because I actually recently, you know, flipped over the back of the Civil War documentary just to see, and they don't even have English subtitles. I'm like, huh, you know, maybe I shouldn't have tried to bite that off, because that was very challenging. That was a difficult, difficult piece of the project. But, I work at a language learning company, so I figured, oh, I have all these resources. I'll just rock that and that'll be awesome. And, you know, I was extremely naive about that. That is a really hard gig.
The translation or the timing?
The timing's actually the easiest part. The translation, you know, and getting, like, you know, two native speakers of a language in the same room to actually agree on a translation, that's super hard. Yeah. And then, you know, just tweaking it so that it looks right, you know. And the timing part, it took a long time to, like, because you have to do these little in-out time codes for every single line.
Right.
But that was actually sort of therapeutic. I didn't even really mind that. I mean, like, the frustration of, oh, it's not perfect. Oh, you know, the translation isn't quite right, you know. And there's a certain amount of that you just have to live with. Be like, you know what? It conveys the general information. And for another thing, it's an indie documentary, you know, like, it's not going to be perfect. It's not like a big Hollywood budget, you know, so
right.
you know, it's a nod at the languages and attempting to get the subtitles in there because they'll be helpful for people. That was real challenging, but that was sort of after the fact. I realized, like, all these films that I sort of assumed had subtitles, like, I went and looked at the DVDs and they didn't. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's just a thing. But yeah, I mean, Ken Burns is actually lives in the same state as I do, so I'm hoping that at some point I can maybe stalk him and find him and tell him that I owe it all to him.
I'm sure he can't be anything but pleased.
I would hope so, but I don't know. Depends on what, you know, quality of a stalker I am.
Mm-hmm. I'll bring him cookies. He'll be fine.
Yeah, there you go.
So you went through this whole production of Going Cardboard, learning all along the way because it was all brand new to you. Is there one lesson in particular you're going to come away from this for future projects?
I guess I would have to say just, you know, trying to get kind of the overall story arc, and you can't always do this, but trying to get some kind of generic story arc in place is important. I would definitely do that. And also that there's going to be disappointment. There's going to be missed opportunities, and you have to just live with that. You know, there are people I really would have loved to get into this film, and it just didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm bummed about that because there were all these cool opportunities. But at the end of the day, like, you can only have so many minutes of footage in there. And that was the other thing. I had, like, you know, 30 bonus clips at the beginning of the week, and now I have 27 because 3 of those would not fit on the DVD. So you have to just make these sacrifices. And also, you know, I had somebody else editing my film. Jason Scott edited it.
Okay.
And he's a known documentary maker. He would make these choices and cut, you know, X, Y, and Z. And sometimes I would push back on it. But to a degree, you know, it's like that's why you need another person in on it, because there are tough choices that have to be made. And sometimes, you know, it's not easy.
Is there an example of a particularly tough choice that you and Jason had words over?
There was this one little segment that I really liked that was just describing these two brothers who are designers, the Lamont brothers. They're from Scotland. They were really cool, and their stories were all very funny. And they had this one about when they were kids playing this game called Buccaneer. And it was just the funniest story, and I loved it so much. And I really wanted it in there, but it really literally was 3 minutes of stuff that we just did not have the space for, so I had to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a little overview about how, you know, Board Game Geek came to be, and that wound up having to go to the bonus clips, but it did have to get cut just for pacing, you know, just to keep things moving, because a file, when you're talking about a documentary, like, and it's so informational, you really do have to be careful with the pacing, or you're going to lose everybody but the complete diehards, you know. And so I think by making all those hard choices and, you know, making those cuts. And the nice thing is a lot of it does end up in the bonus clips. So, you know, these days, the way DVDs are, it's not all lost like it would have been, you know, back in the day before that.
Right.
So that's nice. But at the end of the day, you have to cut some stuff, and it's not going to be pleasant.
Yeah, you make your choices and you live with them.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, they were varying degrees of difficult, but I do think we've wound up with a product that's going to appeal to both noobs to the, you know, genre who, and we did show it to somebody who had not board game before, and she seemed to be into it in general, but mm-hmm. people who haven't done it, real casual gamers and the hardcore gamers, I think there's something in it for all those people. And that's, you know, generally, like they say, don't try to do that. Like, don't try to appeal to multiple audiences, because it's very difficult to do that.
Right.
So, I mean, at its core, I think it's aimed at, you know, experienced, like, board gamers. But it also, just because the medium is so photogenic, and it just really is a neat, you know, and it's a very friendly thing for families and so forth, I think that it'll appeal to other people, too.
Okay, so this is something that a diehard hobbyist could show to concerned loved ones to explain it's okay.
Yes, exactly. And that's actually when I started filming it, several people came up to me and said that. They were just like, this is the movie that I wanted someone to make. You're making the thing that I wanted to have to hand to my friends and say, this is what I do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that there's a lot of responsibility that comes with that. But that's exactly what I wanted to do with it. I wanted it to be a vehicle for people to discover the hobby, because I think once people discover it, they love it. So I think it really is, you know, life enriching when people find out. So if I can help that happen, you know, that's great.
That's a powerful piece of feedback to get from somebody.
Yeah, yeah. So hopefully they still say that after they've seen it. But, you know,
yeah.
In theory.
Are you looking forward to something after getting Going Hard Bard on DVD and on the festival circuit?
Yeah, so we'll do that. You know, we'll do the screenings and the marketing and all that stuff, and that'll be great. And I don't know if by the end of that I'll be recharged or if I'll need like a complete break to kind of really clear, you know, the plate. But I think after that, I have a couple ideas for things, other documentaries that I might like to do that have nothing to do with board gaming. I'm looking forward to actually board gaming. And also, you know, just like doing possibly, you know, some freelance stuff and, you know, helping people and whatever, and just practicing and getting better at it, you know, because the one thing is like going through all these learning curves, it would be lame to just stop,
right,
you know, not do anything else. So I probably will do other stuff, but I'm not entirely sure what yet.
But it was still a positive experience you want to build on.
Oh yeah, definitely. It was a very positive experience. It was so much fun. And I really liked, you know, putting the story together, like with the pieces that I got. It was just like a giant puzzle, you know, and watching it unfold in front of me. It was just really exciting.
So if people want to see Going Cardboard, where are they going to be? Where will it be in the next couple months?
I'm posting on my blog a list of screenings, and we're working on screenings right now, but there's already a half a dozen of them there. So as I get them, I will post them there, the public screenings. And, you know,
And where can people find your blog?
If you just go to boardgamemovie.com, you can find it there, but also it's just boardgamedoc.blogspot.com.
Do you yourself have any concluding thoughts or messages you want to let people know about?
Well, one thing just is, you know, if you have an idea for something like this that you want to do, like, just do it. Just, like, dive in and do it. And also the cautionary thing that if it happens to be a documentary, when people say, like, it takes 4 years to do a documentary, they mean that. It's not a trivial thing, and, like, you'll have no idea how much work it is, you know, before diving in, and that's probably for the best because otherwise nobody would make them. But, you know, just that the tools these days are just so there. If you have a creative idea for a board game too, you know, for anything, just do it. You know, go out and try. And the worst that's going to happen is you're going to fail, but you'll have learned something and, you know, you'll have the experience. Because that's the thing. Even if I somehow, and I never viewed it this way, I never had any doubts that I wasn't going to get to this point and put this thing out. But, you know, even if I had, like, if something had gone horribly wrong, like, you know, like on the trip back from Essen, like, I'd, you know, my computer had been lost and I'd lost all the footage and, like, oh, then I can't do the movie anymore, you know, like, I would still have something, you know, I'd still have the experience and I would build from that, you know. So setbacks are just a normal part of doing anything creative. And if you don't let yourself be stopped, then there's a lot you can accomplish.
That encapsulates it all. Just go out and do it and then you'll have learned from it, if nothing else.
Yeah, seriously. And I mean, not just, like I said, not just for me, like my own project, from seeing those designers and like following their passions. And you'll see when you see the movie, you know, there's this guy in there that had, you know, a nightmare of a time getting his game published, but he was always, you know, cheerful about it. He just kept at it. He didn't let himself be stopped, even though the two publishers he was with both, you know, met untimely ends and wound up not, you know, not publishing his game. And it took like 5 years for him, but he didn't give up. And his name's Brian Johnson, and the game is Island Fortress now. It was Huang Di when I originally interviewed him, but he just this past weekend completed a Kickstarter successfully to fund it. So that's another thing that I should maybe touch on, because it worked for me too, is Kickstarter. If you have a good idea and it's a financial thing, then Kickstarter can be helpful there too. And a lot of people are going that route now.
Mm-hmm. You Kickstarted this?
I did, actually. Mainly not to pay for, you know, the plane trips and all that, because that had already happened, but to pay for the initial DVD run, because that's a pricey proposition. But yeah, so I was just like, you know, it's worth a shot. I could use some help with this. So I just asked. And there are people out there that are looking for cool projects. And if you can sell them on your idea, then people are out there that want to support you. It's just so great. Like, the indie community on, you know, all different fronts is just amazing these days.
Mm-hmm. That is awesome. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and like I said, Brian did too. And now they have a whole, like, games category where people are, you know, putting lots and lots of board games are getting funded through Kickstarter.
Yeah, yeah, I've got a couple I'm frantically watching to make sure they make it.
Yep, yep.
Thank you for coming on the show. It was interesting to hear about the process of the film, and I'm looking forward to seeing it once it's released.
Oh, great, yeah. Thanks very much for having me, and I hope you enjoy it. It'll be pretty soon. Not much longer to wait.
I'm sure everybody's looking forward to it. Thanks, Orion.
Thank you.
Next, we take you to an autopsy of a game.
Hi, welcome to Autopsy of a Game. My name's Tyler, and with me today is...
Sarah.
Chuck.
I'm Rod.
And we're going to talk a bit about L'Hav, another Uwe Rosenberg joint.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah, why don't you lead this off?
This is another game designed by Uwe Rosenberg. His more famous is Agricola, his star game. The theme of L'Hav is a harbor town in France where you're acquiring resources and doing things to those resources, manipulating them in order to get victory points. The interesting thing about L'Hav is that victory points are also money in this game. So you're using the money that you have as a resource you're essentially spending victory points to make more victory points, which is an interesting dynamic.
Mm-hmm. So it really emulates a real-world business in that the money goes in and then the money goes back out.
Right, exactly. And at the end of the game, hopefully you have turned that money into more money. What you will see when you play this game on the board is a series of buildings, pictures of buildings, where those resources will sit, those resources being things like fish, wood, clay, iron, grain, and cattle. Underneath those buildings are the 7 turn symbols, so to speak. Each of those spots also tells you what further resources you will be putting out on a given turn.
Mm-hmm.
You follow those steps, and every 7 turns is the end of a round on which you flip over that round card to become a ship, which is available for purchase or building.
Mm-hmm.
The general idea of how the game works is that on your turn, you have 2 choices. One is you acquire resources direct from a pile, or 2, you do another action. Usually that's building a building or doing something in that building.
So you might buy some raw materials, or you might do something with materials you already own.
Exactly. And that's the essence of the game, is manipulating resources to build things or do things with them.
You would actually build the buildings first and then use the buildings
to manipulate
the resources.
Exactly.
So yeah, it's not just enough to own the clay, you have to buy a kiln or something.
Correct.
To do something with that clay, to turn it into brick. Yes, exactly.
Okay.
So building buildings requires... The terminology is very specific in this game. You can build a building or you can buy a building, and those are very different. You can buy a building at any time using money, just outright. A building shows a particular cost on it. You can buy it at any time.
Mm-hmm.
Building is usually a better value and is how you will gain buildings. And though building a building is based on resources. So it might cost 1 wood and 2 clay, or 1 wood, a clay, and a brick, which is more expensive because you will have had to turn clay into brick. It's a multi-step process in the game.
Basically, you're taking the original resource, you're turning it into an added value resource, and then are usually using that added value resource to either build a building, or you're going to be selling it on to various other buildings, which give you coins, which again turn into victory points at the end, or you're going to be selling it on to the shipping companies or the ships that take it off and give you victory points from shipping it out of town.
Correct. So the essential turn dynamics in the game are simple enough that you have a couple choices and you do them. Of course, where Uwe Rosenberg's games are complicated is the strategy behind them. That because if Tyler owns 2 buildings, let's say,
mm-hmm.
and I want to use one of them, I have to pay you for use of that building.
I'm a fan of that.
So the strategy behind it is figuring out what buildings you should acquire so that the other players will have to pay you to use them.
Okay, so there's interaction in that you're selling services to other players,
correct.
Not just fictional characters or captains or whomever.
Yeah.
Correct. By owning the buildings, you are not only giving yourself the opportunity to use them, but giving other players the opportunity to use them and to pay you for their use.
Mm-hmm.
Just to give an example of some of the buildings, you got like a fish market, which would take the fish, the general fish that you have, which is a resource, and change it into money or victory points.
Mm-hmm.
Also, another building might be the smelter, where you take coal and you would add coke to it, which is a derivative of the coal, mm-hmm. which produces energy to gain iron.
Okay.
Now, iron may be used in something else that you need to create. So it's a series of steps, like Sarah said, a multifaceted or a multi-step process to get to something at the end. It's also, the buildings have a little bit of synergy with them in that you may use one building to lead to another building or to building something else that you need.
An example, a fish is a good example. One card allows you to acquire a stack of fish. Another building will allow you to either sell that fish to get money or turn that fish into smoked fish, which is a higher value of food. And food is another component to the game that you have to watch very carefully. You have to feed your workers or your however you want to phrase it, feed your people mm-hmm. at the end of every round.
Right.
And that amount gets higher as the game goes on. So the first round, you only need to feed 2 food worth. By the end of the game, you may need to feed 15 food worth.
Right. So it's like you're paying your employees for their labor.
Yes. Yeah, you're paying in food.
Which is another design aspect that Uwe Rosenberg has used before, mm-hmm. With Agricola in particular, mm-hmm. is the limited or the taking away of certain resources at the end of a round or
right.
at the end of a turn.
Where you're making choices about what you're going to keep and what
exactly.
goes to feed or pay your people.
Correct.
Sounds like there are certain fields and industries with overlapping buildings and functions that sort of encourage a player to specialize.
Correct, yeah. If you had the market on new physical resource acquisition, that's going to be a good thing. That everyone who needs iron, everyone needs coal, if you have those cards, people will have to come to you at some point during the game, usually multiple points.
Okay, so you're buying up buildings and supply sources. And then throughout this game, it's just figuring out how to make more money come from those things than you're putting in.
Correct, yeah. The more you play the game, the more you know the cards that are potentially out there.
Mm-hmm. Is a lot of variability in games and versus what's coming up as available to use, or is it always like, well, I'm just going to wait till X card comes up and then I'll grab it?
Some are constant. Some buildings are constant, and some buildings vary game to game. They're called special buildings, and it's, I don't know how big the pool is, let's say 20 or 25 cards, and every game you might use 5 of them.
Mm-hmm.
So the different games can be very different based on those special buildings.
It's also, there's a variable in when the buildings will come up.
Yes.
As there's a random way to deal out the buildings.
Mm-hmm.
There's also the possibility of a town taking buildings. And buildings are the main way to score points. They are worth, they have a value at the end of the game, and that is a lot of times what you're doing, the manipulation of the resource leads to building of buildings, which are worth something at the end of the game, or building ship, which are also have value and victory points and money at the end of the game.
Mm-hmm.
There are certainly lots of intricacies to the game that when you sit down and read the rules and play them, there's a lot more to learn, but there's no point in going over it on this podcast, as that would just be a waste of your time.
You really need to sit down and play the game. The game really is relatively simple. But like Sarah said, the strategies can be difficult to wrap your mind around at
yeah.
times.
Mm-hmm.
And
it rewards practice.
Yes.
Correct.
And part of that is the player order and the choices that come out because of where you are in the player order.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
But the game does scale nicely. Like most of UVA's games, it plays 2 to 5. Or actually, I'm not sure if this one plays 1 to 5.
It does play 1 to 5.
1 to 5. But the cards used and how many turns and how much food and other variables are changed based on the number of players involved in the game.
With all of you having played Le Havre before, what mechanical element or section of the game really tickles your gamer sense, as it were?
I think my favorite, what I enjoy about the game, the dynamic, is that there isn't a lot of luck. That the first turn, the first round, there's an element of surprise to it that varies game to game, but there isn't a lot of luck, that you need to be watching what's going on. There's no rolling the dice. I can make my own destiny in the game. I'm not relying on chance.
Sure.
Yeah, it's a game where it's a lot about developing your economy and taking advantage of what the other players have developed to the best of your advantage. Because you want to basically get a working economy going for yourself, where you're getting fish or whatever raw materials you are going, and you're developing it through the various other buildings you've bought, and then you've got a way to sell them all to maximize your resources through the whole game. And as you develop that, you get the synergy of all the stuff you've been doing, and if you're lucky, you end up winning the game.
For me, it's seeing the different strategies unfold in a game like this, and Agricola is another game like that. I can sit down and play this game no matter how many times I've played it, and with a different player, I will see a different strategy develop. Again, the variables of when the buildings come out can affect that, but they may try a strategy that I've never seen before, and that's what I really like about some of these games that Rosenberg does, that there are various strategies to victory. The paths are seemingly endless.
Yeah.
So it sounds like a game with a lot of replay value then.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think
definitely. Okay. So if somebody's looking for this game, they can still find it in stores because it's in print, right?
Yes.
It is still in print.
It's not the most inexpensive game. It's $75, I think.
Yeah, it can be. But you get a lot of bits with that. I mean, you obviously have a lot of resources. And cards, with a game that scales like this one does for the number of players, the number of cards scales as well, so you have a lot of good cards.
And they're all nice-looking bits.
They are all nice-looking bits. The art is nice. The boards are minimal, kind of like Agricola, where the boards kind of fit together and you just need to, for storing stuff, everyone has their own play area.
Right.
But yeah, this game is readily available right now.
There's also an expansion, which certainly adds to replay value. It adds, the expansion is tiny, it's just a new card deck. It adds new buildings. I believe that's it, new buildings, but that certainly changes the game again.
It's called Grand Hameau.
Well, that sounds delightful.
Yes. It's French, obviously, and my French is terrible. But, yeah, like Sarah said, it adds new buildings, And the special buildings, I've played, like I said, I've played a number of times, and I don't think I've seen every special building come out yet. So, the replayability is really quite high in this.
Not a cheap date, but definitely worth it for how many times you can play the game.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Cool. Sarah, Chuck, Rod, thank you for talking about Metal Hawk for Autopsy of the Game.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
No problem.
You've been listening to Carnage Cast, a production of NNEG LLC. All rights reserved. For more information, visit us at www.carnagecon.com.
Look on the bright side, you won't have far to go when I send you straight to hell.